19 horas en el Salón de Plenos de la Junta de Distrito de Retiro, en la Plaza Daoiz y Velarde número 2.
You're listening to the right radio. You're listening to Vaughn Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization. From Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughn Radio. Now, on this program, I'm going to talk a little bit about ancient Greece and the beginnings of ancient Greece. This is a sort of introduction that I'm going to be using to talk about my favorite historian, the father of history, Herodotus. Maybe we can begin with him later in the program, or at least with how he begins his history. History meaning inquiry or investigation or research. That's what he liked to call it. That's the name for it. And that's what history actually means, an investigation. The thing is that just from the very beginning, the proem, it's called, the first words in his work, Herodotus is saying that he is going to perform, in other words, to recite. In other words, this was a performance. This was something he did. It was not meant to be read. It was meant to be heard, like so many other things in the ancient world. Well, he's going to perform his investigation, or the results of his investigation. He's going to display, to show us the results of his research. Herodotus, back in a time, well, much, much earlier. Let's talk about 700 years earlier. No, more. Yes. 700 years earlier. There was a ship in southern Turkey. It was discovered in 1954. It was a Pethio at that time. Pethio, the Spanish word Pethio, comes from pieza, believe it or not, and the pethio is la ruina de un naufrago. It's a ship that has been sunk, a ship that has been wrecked. In English, we use wreck, like the wreck of the Titanic, a shipwreck. The Spanish word for that is pethio. Now, the word, the pethio in question was at Cape Caledonia in southern Turkey, and the main cargo, when it was investigated about, 1960, they began to investigate. They found that the main cargo was copper naturally from Cyprus. On my last program, I mentioned that Cyprus, Chipre, is named because of copper, precisely because of copper. There was bronze, but bronze that they had been collecting to melt and to rework, refashion. And there was a white material with the texture of toothpaste. That's how they described it. And that white material was tin oxide, no, óxido de estaño. And this tin oxide, where could that have possibly come from? Also on board, there were scales, basculas, and weights. So, there were different standards, but naturally, because the ship was going to go into different areas using different weights and measures. But the largest collection was from the Near East. And so, logically, the ship would have come from, say, Lebanon. Now, this would have been, again, later excavations with a metal detector found that there was metal all under the sea. There was metal right until the rock on which the ship had struck and began to sink. And then later in 1982, 22 years after this excavation had been made, another ship was discovered near the town of Kash, also in southern Turkey, not very far from the wreck I was just talking about, a place called Uluburun. Now, carbon dating indicated that this ship was about 100 years older than the previous one from the same place, or at least that is the determination they came to, using the earlier ship as a sort of model, as a basis. If that ship came from southern Lebanon, then this ship would have come from southern Lebanon as well. A major item of cargo, of what it was transporting, were jars, amphorae. They were contained in amphora that are typical of that region. You know, sometimes amphora are standardized, sometimes they are noticeably sort of eccentric or unique to a specific region. Some of those jars contained olives. One contained something a little like aguarrás, no? This derivative from pine, we call it turpentine in English. It's called terebinth. It is like turpentine, but it is used as a basis for perfumes and medicine. And this particular cargo would have come from somewhere around the Dead Sea, no, el Mar Muerto, somewhere around there. There were ingots, lingotes, ingots, we don't use the L, so ingot, copper ingots, and tin ingots. The tin from South Central Turkey and Afghanistan. And, all sorts of glass, right? At that time, it was the Phoenicians who made glass. Glass and these glass ingots were lavender-colored, turquoise-colored, turquesa, turquoise, and very, very dark blue, cobalt blue. There were exotic woods from Africa. There were ivory, the marfil, no? The tusks of the elephants. The colmillo de elefante is called a tusk in English. The colmillo, the tusk, made of ivory. There were also the teeth of hippopotamus. And the shell of a tortoise. There were ostrich shells, avestruz. There were stones, gold, silver, all sorts of different weapons, armas, weapons from different cultures, right? Daggers and arrows and things. There was almond, pine nut, piñon, fig, grape, and pomegranate, granada. And there were all sorts of things for measuring, for weights, basculas, pesos, things that, tablets for recording transactions, business transactions, and some of them with very, very precise measuring systems. So things of great value that required a very, very precise way to measure, that was all there. there were 18,000 different items cataloged from Mycenaean Greece, from Assyria, Babylon, from Sudan. And so all of this, as I say, all of this back in the Bronze Age, which really had very, very little in it that was primitive, could ever be called primitive. So yeah, the idea that all the way back then, they had so many different products from all over the world at their disposal that the network of commerce, of interchange, of exchange of ideas was already so advanced. You can imagine now what, 700 years later, you have, again, the father of the historians, the first of the great historians, you have Herodotus. And one of the things Herodotus is going to do is not simply tell his side of the story. Before then, you might have a poem. And if there's a great battle, you either attribute the victory in the battle to the heroism of the ruler, let's say the pharaoh, or the shah, you would attribute everything to him and give him some semi-divine power. You would make him into a demigod. And this would be pure elogio, praise, hagiography. The man can do nothing wrong. And so, in many cases, yes, we find hieroglyphs in Egypt talking about a great victory. And the archaeological evidence on the battlefield indicates that it was a terrific, horrific defeat for the Egyptians. And yet, the chronicles call it a victory. So, in this case, this is nothing like that. Previous to this, in addition, you know, you can win or you can lose, but in every aspect, the gods are present. The gods move people. The gods give us dreams. The gods give us inspiration. If a man makes a decision, it's because something he saw in a dream, and the god placed that dream in his brain. As sometimes the dreams are false, as in, this happens again and again in the Trojan War. Well, now it's not going to be so much that as the people who have done magnificent things, famous people, and their enemy is time. And Herodotus wants to protect what these people have said and done against the destructive force of time, against the unnatural power of forgetfulness, of oblivion, falling away and not knowing what happened, ignorance. Well, let's start with Croesus. Croesus from Lydia. And this is another thing. Croesus, again, not a Greek. Croesus is, all of this is going to be talking about the difference between East and West and why West and East are so different. Whether it is the nature of the East to be that different. It's trying to act as a bridge between the two cultures to promote understanding. Asiatics say that Europe is alien and that the cultures are irreconcilable or at least this is what Herodotus tells us. He says, they believe that the Greeks will always be their enemies. But he wants to explain why. And he gives a number of explanations because he is not content to provide one single one. The time when Herodotus is writing was 40 years after the story that he tells. Xerxes, the king of Persia, led an invasion of Greece. Now, the Persian Empire had grown. Herodotus talks about this, the Medians and the Persians, and how they'd grown and how this kind of military adventure became natural to them. In fact, Cyrus the Greek saying that if they become too powerful, if they conquer too much, then they're going to become comfortable. If they become comfortable, they will be weak, and they will no longer conquer. So yes, they know what's going on. These military adventures were their style. Rapid victory appeared to be what they did best. And they seemed absolutely invincible, so that many of the different potential enemies they had would just collapse under them. They would just give up. But then in the space of a generation, well, they had completely swept, arrasado, right, the Middle East, and arrived at a huge empire going from the Indus River all the way to the Aegean Sea. And as a result, the ruler, Xerxes, was far and away the most powerful man on the planet. Now, what he had available to him on any caprice, right, any whim, that's only comparable to, maybe no one, not even the Roman emperors, have had that much force at their power ever since. And yet, Greece manages to hold out. Not the town that Herodotus came from himself. That fell. That was absorbed into the empire. And the Greeks absorbed into the Persian Empire became loyal Persians and cooperated with the Persians. They became integrated into the empire. It was very difficult for Greeks to understand how this could be possible. But this is another thing that Herodotus tries to explain to us. He wants to begin to explain the conflict, not in the remote past, or at least not in a past so remote as to be fictitious, as to be legend, or as to be influenced by the activities of a god, but rather to give us an explanation that makes sense, on the one hand, that sounds reasonable to anyone, even today, and on the other hand, something that he has seen proof of. In other words, that he can verify. Because in this story, he talks about rumors he's heard that he doesn't believe. Things that might be true, but he really doesn't know. Or things that he has seen himself. And he always makes sure to distinguish that. And remember, that the most important thing about Herodotus in these histories is that the other side is as important, as noteworthy, as memorable, as human as the Greek side. So that, yes, later on, Herodotus, subsequently, in later centuries, there are going to be many Greeks that are going to characterize Herodotus as philo-barbarous, right? Barbarian lover. And there are many people who are going to be most offended by how he characterized Greeks, certain Greeks, as having ignoble motives for their actions. And, well, Herodotus is definitely not without controversy. But then he goes to talk about everything he sees, all of the extras. In any case, toward the beginning of his investigation, of his inquiry, of his research, which is history. This is where we get the word history. He talks about Croesus. Croesus living in Sardis in Lydia, what is today the Anatolian Peninsula. Lydia, remember, near where money was invented. And Lydia, very, very famous for its money. Later on, we'll be talking about Midas. No, the Midas touch, the ancient King Midas, his grandson. And all of these legends, because money came from here, and money was perhaps one of the greatest inventions of the ancient world. Money gave us an economy, a means of exchange that was undreamt of before. Made our lives so much easier, and all of that, of course, from Lydia. Croesus, and in English, until relatively recently, when people did study the ancient world and when people knew a lot about the ancient world, you could say, in English, you could say, that man is as rich as Croesus. And everybody would understand what you meant. Today, older people will probably understand, but young people do not study the ancient world as assiduously as they used to. Or at least, they are not forced to study the ancient world as assiduously as they used to be. But rich as Croesus has kind of fallen out of the vocabulary, and people tend to use the names of millionaires or billionaires contemporary to us. But Croesus was the paragon until relatively recently. Croesus began to reign over Lydia at the age of 35. Croesus made war on all of the Greeks that were living in the western parts of Asia. In other words, all of the Ionian Greeks. He would look for any excuse for a fight with every city. And if he could not find some great matter, he would use a little thing. And all of these cities, well, first of all, the first city he fought against was Ephesus. Everybody knows Ephesus. Ephesus is famous to us because it comes out in the Bible, in the New Testament, the Ephesians, the book of the Ephesians and so forth. Ephesus, a splendid city, a port city in the ancient world, which unfortunately dried up. The port became mud, and now Ephesus is more than a kilometer from the coast. But it is still visited by something like 2.5 million tourists per year, most of them interested in this biblical sort of echo that the name gives. But remember that in the ancient world, Ephesus was home to one of the seven wonders of the world. It was the Temple of Artemis, one of the most enormous and splendid things of its day. Now, the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus was destroyed by a man who wanted his name to go down in history. And so, there are many historians, I'm going to be one of them, and many historians who conspicuously, deliberately avoid giving you his name. So that his name cannot go down in history. One day we will forget who he was and what he did. But in any case, yes, he deliberately burned down the temple of Artemis at Ephesus. Now, Ephesus was the first of the cities that Croesus fought against. I have to take a break. I'll be back in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Right Radio. You're listening to Vaughn Radio.
Vuelve el seminario que tanto éxito está teniendo sobre emprendimiento y liderazgo, con dos líderes, Richard Vaughan y Javier Fernández Aguado. Y esta vez, Richard Vaughan lo impartirá en inglés. No faltes a esta nueva convocatoria, jueves 24 de octubre, de 16:30 a 20:30 horas, en la sede central de Vaughan, en la calle Orense 69, primera planta. Entra ahora en grupovaughan.com/seminario.
Las clases de inglés organizadas en las empresas no funcionan. Las empresas tiran el dinero. Llevo 45 años observando este fenómeno y todavía me asombra la capacidad que tienen las empresas para invertir dinero y tiempo de sus empleados a cambio de nada. Rentabilidad cero, tiempo perdido, lío administrativo, celeridad inútil. Llevo toda mi vida profesional tratando de convencer a las empresas a cambiar su enfoque. Y, como al buen predicador en el desierto, no me hacen caso. Si usted quiere que su empresa pase de ser una empresa monolingüe a una empresa bilingüe, búsqueme, escúcheme. Si al final, como siempre, desoye mis palabras y vuelve a la senda del despilfarro, no me eche a mí la bronca. Ni el 1% del dinero que he ganado todos estos años al servicio de las empresas en España ha sido productivo. Ni el 1%. Y no por culpa mía. Empresas, déjense guiar por mí. Dejen que les asesore de verdad. No intenten decirme cómo realizar la intervención, la cirugía. Ustedes no son cirujanos, yo lo mío sí. ¿Acaso dirían a un cardiólogo cómo ha de efectuar su labor? Entonces, ¿por qué desde siempre se creen legitimados para decirme a mí cómo operar? Yo les resolveré las carencias del inglés en su organización. Sé hacerlo, pero no con su instrumental, sino con el mío.
Tienes grandes profesionales en tu empresa, pero ¿no dominan el inglés? Vaughan es el mejor aliado para potenciar tu empresa y prepararla para el mercado internacional. Más de 40 años formando a empresas y a sus empleados. Llámanos sin compromiso. 911-33-5831. Toma nota. 911-33-5831.
Si no te apuntas a los 6 días en Vaughan Town, lo único que podemos recomendar a cambio son 6 meses viviendo y trabajando en el extranjero, en un país de habla inglesa. Solo 6 días en Vaughan Town te aupa más que 6 meses fuera. ¿No nos crees? Manda a Vaughan Town a un amigo empleado que esté desesperado con el inglés y obsérvale 6 días después. El cambio que verás te sorprenderá. La inversión en tiempo y dinero tendrá un retorno impresionante.
¿Todavía no conoces la masterclass gratuita que imparte Richard Vaughan? Aprende y disfruta del inglés como nunca lo has hecho. Entrada libre y gratuita. Te esperamos el lunes 7 a las 19 horas en el Salón de Plenos de la Junta de Distrito de Retiro en la Plaza Daoiz y Velarde número 2.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughn Radio. Now, on the first part of the program, I was talking about ancient Greece in general, especially the oldest times, and even from the oldest times, even from the Bronze Age, the Greeks, that area, the Near East, had a massive connection with all of the different cultures around it. The commerce there, the intercontinental sea commerce, all of it so rich, so extensive, so, let's call it, fecund, so fertile for the imagination and for understanding. Well, all of it, just beyond compare. I mean, it is shocking to us today to think how well developed they were back then. How they had nothing, absolutely nothing primitive about them. And then I began to talk about Herodotus, my hero, the father of history, and begin to talk about Herodotus's book. Herodotus begins pretty much by talking about Croesus. I spoke about Croesus of Lydia, and Croesus at one point, Croesus, after years of conquest, all Asia west of the river Halys had been conquered by Croesus, and his kingdom was big, with great wealth and honor. And into his capital, Sardis, became one of the wisest of all the Greeks, Solon of Athens. Now, in the year 621 BC, back in Athens, the Athenian aristocrats had abused their power. One of them, a man named Draco meaning dragon, Draco meaning, for example, Dracula. Dracula means little dragon. In the Harry Potter series, Drago Malfoy, right? The little dragon of bad faith. That's what his name means. So, Draco, who might not have been, it means snake. In any case, he was a snake. He is the one who allegedly wrote the first law code in Athens. They said it was written in blood. Draco was, in all of his laws, like the Code of Hammurabi, right? If you do this, this will happen. If you do that, that will happen. If you do this, and all of it, very, very strict, very inflexible. And, for the slightest infraction, the punishment is inordinate, right? And there is no mercy. There's no sympathy for anybody who breaks these codes. And these codes were applied in a particularly strict way against the poor people. So yeah, the lower classes, they had no privilege. And because it was Draco's code, we have a word called draconian. So a draconian law, a law which is really seriously unfair, because it does not allow anything beyond black or white. It is too strict, too strong. This draconian code of laws mandated the death penalty for an enormous number of crimes, including laziness, including stealing fruit. Anybody unable to pay their debts was, of course, reduced to slavery. And once a slave, taken to the market, sold, or forced to sell their children at the slave market. This aristocratic monopolization turned small farmers into peasants, right? Into people who had to leave the land, right? You would start this process of latifundistas, and all of the small farmers that formed the backbone of Athenian society, all of them were being reduced to poverty under the system. The aristocratic system of government monopolized power, and so the middle class, which was created by Athens' circumstances, the middle class, which actually had a lot of money and power at its disposal, but they had no access to the political system. So naturally, something had to give. Remember that Athens, the whole area, Attica around there, is bad land, and you can't, you know, it's not really fertile. You can't grow anything really decent there. Not even enough to feed its own population. And so what they started out doing is specializing in olives. And with olive trees, you've got olive oil. And olive oil from Attica was highly prized, or at least they knew how to sell it. They knew how to make people desire it and pay good money. So yes, maybe the Athenians were natural salesmen. Or maybe that was objectively the highest quality of olive oil there was. We don't know. But people wanted it. And so Athens was able to live from commerce, which meant a commercial class, a middle class. Not the aristocrats, not the people with land, not the people with power, but people willing to invest their money on very risky things, like ships. Now, a little later on, it wasn't just the olive oil that people wanted. When it was time for the Athenians to transport the oil, these were located in, you know, the oil and what the other products they were transporting were in jars, amphorae, and not just those jars, but other ceramics, decorative ceramics. Athens began to specialize in decorative ceramics. There were ceramics for the wine ceremony. There were ceramics for funeral ceremonies. There were ceramics, and all of a sudden, everybody wanted the Athenian ceramics. They were beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. You can see them in many, many of the museums around the world. Wherever there's a collection of art from ancient Greece, you will see some examples of these ceramics, the kind that the Athenians were actually the first to produce. And so they began to live off their ceramic trade, off their commerce. And this is completely, completely incompatible with a small minority of aristocrats monopolizing the decisive power. So yeah, in the year 594 BC, these Athenian aristocrats took the step to prevent a revolution. They named a man called Solon as the dictator. Let's call him that. He was the lone archon for the year. And they gave him absolute power to change the law, to revise the law. Solon, the lawgiver. He had become famous for his poems His poems were moralistic, right? They were against injustice, against greed, right? Avarice, cupidity. And the first thing Solon did, once he was in power, once he had this authority, was to eliminate the draconian legal code, then cancel all the debts, then forbid the practice of debt slavery, and liberate people who had been enslaved because of this. He bought Athenians who had been sold as slaves outside Athens. He bought them back for the city, paid good money for that. Now, at this point, he was able to persuade the nobles to invest in this commercial enterprise that I was talking about, the future of Athens. He was able to interest the nobles in becoming merchants, which isn't easy. I mean, for example, think of part of the curse of Spain and the Spanish empires. One of the very, very worst things about Spain, even in its golden days, was the idea that commercial activity, earning a living, right, having to work, was somehow debasing, was something that an aristocrat, a noble, wouldn't do, certainly not voluntarily, that there was something shameful about engaging in commercial activity. If you did it, and many people did, you didn't want to talk about it, right? Because it wasn't a nice topic. I mean, the idea was to be a man of leisure, of independent income, and not to think about things as mundane as earning a living or working or commerce or anything like that. This was one of the most terrible aspects of the Spanish Empire, and of course something that even in the Americas today, countries that became independent but were once part of that empire, they still look back at this legacy of disdain for hard work as being quintessential to the Spanish system. And I know that many people would argue that this is an unfair stereotype. But at the same time, I mean, that's exactly what you had. There were people, look at Diego Velázquez, right? During the later years of his life, when he really wanted to be a member of the aristocracy, and when he was really high up in the palace, and when he was really trying to become one of the knights of the order, military order of Santiago, he had to tell people that painting was his hobby, and he had never painted for money, never done anything as vulgar as money. Painting for money. No, that was all, he didn't paint for a living. No, it was all a hobby. And so in the later parts of his life, you know, when he could have been more active as a painter, he didn't do it because he didn't want that, the stigma of having to work for a living, of not being a natural aristocrat. So yes. This is something that Solon, although this is something that's very common, not just in Spain, but it was very characteristic of the Spanish Empire, but in the, well, pretty much everywhere where you have aristocrats and you have merchants, You have a mutual disdain. And in this case, Solon encouraged the Athenian nobility to invest in olive oil and in ceramics. And Solon also encouraged the very best foreign craftsmen, the metics, to settle in Athens by giving them the offer of citizenship. All of this was done by Solon. Offer citizenship to foreigners on a scale that was unprecedented, just unheard of in the ancient world. In addition to which, Solon declared that every citizen would have to teach his son to write and teach his son to practice a trade, un oficio. Unbelievable. So yes, this was so revolutionary, let's call it that, revolutionary, that Solon is well remembered for this. And at the end of his year as archon, Solon decided that he had better leave. So few people were happy with his reforms. There were many, many nobles that were infuriated by, well, the worst thing he did, I mean, and the most disruptive thing for the economy was to cancel all the debts. You can imagine. And many of the poor were upset by the fact that he refused to redistribute the land. What they wanted was a minifundia, which of course, in most cases, are not economically viable. Now, Athens, of course, was not a democracy, but Solon left. By the time Solon left, he was persona non grata. And it was wise for him to leave. He had the pretext of saying that he wanted to see the world. But, first he went to Egypt. And there in Egypt is where he heard the story for the first time of the island of Atlantis. So they think that the Greek imagination, you know, the fixation on Atlantis came from this conversation of a priest, an Egyptian priest, with Solon. In any case, Solon visited Croesus. And so, Solon of Athens, who had made the laws and then left, living abroad for a period of 10 years. He said he did this so that he could see foreign countries, but obviously, at least according to Herodotus, he departed so that he would not have to be forced to change these laws that he had so recently instituted. The Athenians themselves could not change any of them because they had sworn, they had sworn to the gods, solemnly declared that they would not. And so they were incapable of changing any of them without the presence of Solon, and Solon was not going to be present. Solon came to Sardis, and Croesus entertained him in the palace. On the third or fourth day, the king ordered his servants to show Solon all of the royal treasures. The servants showed him pretty much everything Croesus possessed, which was a lot. And At the end of this, there was an audience in which Croesus asked him, Man of Athens, I have heard so much of you, of your wisdom and your travels, and they say that you have traveled over many lands looking for knowledge. And so I want to ask you one question. Who do you think is the happiest man you have ever seen? And you can bet. This is called in English fishing for a compliment, right? Pescar un cumplido, pescar un elogio. Fishing for a compliment because he had every right, you know, every reason to think, oh, you are the most happy man I've ever seen. Well, no. Solon said, oh, king, the happiest man I've ever seen was Tellus. Tellus of Athens. Tellus the Athenian. And, Croesus said, well, why do you think Tellus the Athenian was so very happy? And Solon said, well, his country was in great prosperity, too, and all of his children grew up fair and noble, and all of his children had children, and not one of them died. And everything he did in life met with prosperity. At the end of his days, when the Athenians fought with neighbors of theirs in Eleusis, he came and helped his countrymen, and fought with great honor, died with great honor. The Athenians buried him in the same place where he fell, and they remember him to this day. And that is not what Croesus wanted to hear. Croesus said, okay, who was the next happiest after Tellus? And Solon said, the next happiest after Tellus were the two brothers, Cleobus and Bitten, of the city of Argos. They lived in a way that was good enough for them. They had the strength much greater than other men. Not only did they win prizes for their strength, but the men of Argos held a feast to Hera, who had a great and famous temple in their city. And the mother of these two young men was a priestess in that temple. She was supposed to be drawn, llevado un carro, right? Drawn in a wagon from the city to the temple. But the ox were not there. They had not come in from the fields. So, because this question was urgent, because it was a religious ceremony, and it had to be done, the young men put themselves on the wagon and began to draw it. No, tirar de ello, to draw. So, they are drawing the wagon. Their mother, the priestess, sat on four, and they came all the way to the temple, and when they had done this, with the entire town assembled there, they died. And it was such a death that left nothing to be desired. The gods indicated to the people that it was far better for a man to die like that than to live. When all the people of Argos came out and appraised the youth for their strength, and the women praised the mother that she had such noble sons and the joy of her heart, and Cleobus and Bitten, they lay down to sleep in the temple and never woke up, and so ended their days. The men of Argos commanded that they should make statues of these young men offered to the gods at Delphi. And again, he didn't know what to say. Croesus wanted to hear that he was the happiest man. And Solon told him, in the end, that I'm not going to tell you that because you cannot call a man happy until his days are over. Anything can happen. Just to say the word happy to somebody who's still alive is a mistake. And Croesus thought that Solon had just said the stupidest thing he had ever heard in his life. Croesus was very angry and went away. But later on, of course, he learned a valuable lesson. I don't have time to explain that lesson now. But if you listen to my next program, I'll tell you everything.
Las clases telefónicas Blended surgieron a raíz de varias peticiones de distintos clientes que tenían la necesidad de reforzar la estructura gramatical dentro del idioma, pero a la vez necesitaban muchísima flexibilidad. Alumnos que viajan constantemente, que no se pueden comprometer, sobre todo a una hora y a un día fijo con un profesor, o bien porque les surgen muchas reuniones en el último momento. ¿Cuál es el valor añadido de estas clases telefónicas Blended? Que por un lado tienen la parte de autoestudio del alumno, que es muy importante de cara a poder interiorizar los conceptos que una persona está estudiando, que además sigue una estructura muy similar a la que sigue en lo que podría seguir un libro. Lo que pasa es que lo hemos digitalizado, tiene audios, tiene vídeos y tiene ejercicios también sobre esos audios, esos vídeos, esos puntos gramaticales que se están estudiando, para también el alumno